The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets. My name is Paul Hill. I'm delighted today to be able to speak to accomplished fund manager Brendan Gulston of Gresham House. So welcome, Brendan.
Thanks, Paul. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, we've got lots of sort of cross currents in the markets that I need some help on, that's for sure. And not least the sort of the ongoing wars in the Middle East and Ukraine, offset by sort of falling inflation expectations and also interest rates, etc. But putting all that together, what's your sort of outlook for UK equities, particularly in your sort of sweet spot of sort of smaller mid caps?
Yeah, never-ending wars. I think there's sort of probably two things here. There's the kind of the backdrop, you know, the wider macro and geopolitical backdrop and, you know, the kind of fundamentals of, you know, the context in which we're operating. And then there's probably the sort of question around, you know, within the UK market, where are things trading and, you know, what are they pricing in? And, you know, I'm definitely not a macroeconomist and, you know, so I'm not going to try and make a prediction around, you know, certain macro factors. But I think if we look back over the last sort of 4 or 5 years, I think where we are now, it kind of looks like the backdrop is improving slightly, really. I think in terms of, you know, inflation reducing, interest rates are being priced to reduce. You know, I think within the UK equity sort of fund flows, I'm not going to say that that's now suddenly in, you know, massive net inflow territory and everything's rosy there. But, you know, it early data shows that it is, you know, certainly the net outflows are reducing slightly, and it kind of does feel that way in terms of a bit more stability in the market. So, you know, notwithstanding your point around, you know, geopolitical uncertainty, wars, etc., it does feel like it's potentially improving in terms of the backdrop. Mm. And then I suppose there's a question around, you know, where are we, what are we seeing in the UK markets? And I think that, you know, whilst maybe the fundamentals are looking slightly better in terms of macro, you know, the where the UK sort of equities are priced, that hasn't really improved that much. It, you know, it's possibly, you know, improved a little bit over the last sort of 12 to 18 months, but, you know, the valuations for some really high quality businesses, they're very, very low still. So, you know, I think the dislocation between, you know, those two sets of factors is really quite attractive. And, you know, the other thing worth mentioning is just that within, you know, if you look at UK small cap, it, you know, does fall faster during a market decline or a sell-off versus the all share. It will, you know, UK small caps will fall about 20% more. Mm. But when they recover, they rebound about 80% more. So, we've looked at the data from, you know, right back to the kind of 1998 sell-off and recovery to early 2000, all the way through to where we are now. And, you know, even the last 5 years, as I said, we had a fair share of sell-offs, but, you know, we're sort of sitting here having had 2022 and 2023, two consecutive down years for the UK small cap market. I don't think we've ever had three in a row since 1955. So, you know, if you believe that, you know, those fundamentals are kind of looking, there's quite a few data points that would suggest that we could be set for a recovery. And if we are, then we know that UK small caps will, you know, likely to rebound much faster. So positive, you know, potential kind of positive signs there.
Yeah. What are you, just in terms of sort of that disconnect between sort of small caps and the sort of the improving economics, how have you seen the sort of like that translate into the sort of the recent trading updates from sort of small and mid caps in the UK? Because for some reason, the wind has been taken out the sails in the last 2 months, whereas they had a really good, strong Santa rally.
Yeah, I think that certainly over the last couple of months, I think there have been some elevated kind of profit warnings and a bit tougher sort of results announcements that we've seen. And, you know, that's not unsurprising given, you know, given this UK and a technical recession. And, you know, when you look more broadly across the world, that, you know, that we should expect that there's going to be a tightening of you know, sort of business spending, and we've already seen consumer spending sort of being much tighter as well. So I think, you know, looking forward, I would expect there to be probably ongoing profit warnings in certain areas, which are, you know, if you're looking at, you know, parts of the market that are not business critical in terms of the product or the service, or, you know, big ticket consumer discretionary, for example, you know, that should probably remain fairly challenged. So I think we've seen, you know, we have seen some areas that have been, you know, in terms of profit warning activity has been sort of elevated in some areas. I think it just really depends. It's quite case by case, really. You know, there's been a raft of companies, a number of which we hold, who've, you know, been in line or sort of beaten expectations as well.
And then sold off.
Yeah, and then the share prices have gone down.
Oh, no. Yeah. It's just frankly complexity. Now, one thing I know a lot of investors, and myself included, have been scratching our head, is we've had this sort of splurge in M&A, particularly sort of like in the small cap sector, over the last sort of 3 to 6 months, which I would have thought would have meant there's a lot of new cash in the coffers and in the pockets of sort of fund managers, et cetera, particularly in the active side. But still, regardless of the extra sort of proceeds, the market has still been relatively soft, i.e. it hasn't gone into the market as big a boost as I'd expected. But also it's the you know, ability to companies to raise new money in secondary funding is just so tough again. I was just trying to, can you just talk through that sort of disconnect? Because you'd have expected with more money coming in from M&A, that would have sort of like moved into stocks, which hasn't been the case.
Yeah, I think the challenge that you're seeing there is still that fund flow dynamic. So, you know, whilst I said it looks like it's improving slightly, I think we're still in net outflow territory. I think we have been since, I think, May 2021 in the UK. So you're right. We've had, you know, this huge amount of private capital, particularly, you know, private equity, which has been deployed into the UK public markets because of where valuations are, not just on, you know, on a sort of relative to global equities, but, you know, also relative to what they would pay in the private market. So there's significant multiple arbitrage there. We've, as you say, we've seen, you know, that's really been directed in the small cap space. So I think last year, about 90% of the takeovers were sub 500 million market cap.
Yeah.
And we've seen, you know, as a function of the lower valuations, we've seen bid premium elevated last year to about 60% on average versus 40% over a five-year average. Some areas almost as high as 100%. I think financial services was something like 100%.
Yeah.
So there is a lot of activity, and that is, you're right, that's going to, should, all else being equal, that should be really supportive for UK fund managers and, you know, being able to deploy more capital. But I think, you know, it's just the challenge is that the outflows are still there, and until those, you know, until there's greater stability in that, you know, in that sort of fund flow dynamic, then, you know, there's probably less capital to deploy into the UK market. But the sort of fundraising environment again is interesting. It's, you know, I believe the IPO market is, you know, it's cyclical. If you look back over 5, 10 plus years, you can track the cyclicality of it in terms of, you know, demand, number of IPOs, and the amount of capital raised. It also tracks pretty closely valuation multiples. So, you know, I think as soon as we start to close that gap in terms of, you know, the valuation gap between public and private, but also versus other, you know, global equity classes, then, you know, that's going to be a key catalyst to sort of open the IPO market again. And, you know, it's not that long ago that I think it was 2021 has been one of the highest years for capital raised by IPOs within the last 10 to 20 years. So it's not that long ago that, you know, we were seeing some quite, you know, material sort of fundraisings in the primary market. And, you know, so hopefully things will, you know, there's a few things that are probably already sort of on the horizon this year, but it's early days, but, you know, we expect that to come back at some point.
Yeah. I think actually part of it is just actual confidence, not only on the sort of like, you know, the fund managers, but also sort of professional investors who have sort of smaller portfolios and they hold sort of large caps or bonds or whatever. and they've been battered in small cap land for 2 years, and they're just like, do I really want to go all in now and sort of like miss an opportunity later on? And it's sort of like they're just hedging their bets. And it's that classic bottoming, I think, of the market, is that people see a tick up, think it's there, and then sort of like, okay, well, let's just take our foot off the gas and let's have some dry powder. Just for, if there is an opportunity, we can always deploy later if it's a slightly higher. So I think it's a bit of a sort of confidence. Anyway, let's move on to some sort of specific stocks, et cetera, because we've got one. You talked about that sort of like private equity stroke listed arbitrage opportunity. And one is IOMart. Now, this used to be an absolute darling of AIM. It operates sort of data centers and does IT managed services, largely into the SME sector. And I know that hasn't been as hot as the big, large cap sort of hyperscalers, because I think Amazon Web Services has said it's seen softness in its small caps, whereas its big cap sort of clients have really sort of gone into AI, etc. So there is that. But when you look at it in the lens of sort of private equity stroke, you know, listed companies, it does seem to be an extremely cheap valuation, because I'm looking at it, it's about 12 and a half times PE and just about 5.5 times EBITDA at current levels. What's your sort of like, why is this thing so cheap? Even Equinix, which is the poster child out in the States, is on sort of like, you know, 20 times EBITDA or 20 times plus EBITDA.
Yeah. So look, I agree with you. I think it's, you know, the valuation is wrong. There is a slight nuance in that, you know, these businesses do have some sort of CapEx investment spend on the data centers. So you have to sort of adjust the EBITDA for that. But it's still single digit EBITDA multiples, this business. And, you know, it's had, I think if you look back over the last few years, it's had some challenge from, it's had some profit warnings, I think due to some elevated churn within the customer base. But I think that's sort of largely been addressed now. And I think that the value proposition is really attractive. And, you know, you've got this sort of shift to cloud, which, you know, people may be very familiar with, but, you know, if you look at, in reality, if you look at how many businesses have yet to actually complete that transition to cloud, there's still a significant opportunity there. So that's the first point in terms of kind of the market that they're operating in is structurally attractive. I think, you know, the second point is really around this sort of idea of hybrid cloud services. So, you know, as you said, within the mega caps, very large corporates, you know, they may go to an AWS or Azure and be able to get great pricing, and that's all they need. But for the, you know, SME space, that being able to offer a kind of hybrid between the public cloud and private cloud services is, you know, it's not that common. And, you know, IOMart are a leading player in that space. And, you know, so and those businesses are no different really from the large cap businesses that are, you know, moving across that transition in order to sort of drive operational efficiencies. So, you know, I think that their value proposition is really attractive. It's in a, you know, a kind of a decent market in terms of backdrop, and, you know, 4 or 5 times EBITDA. You know, it's an acquisitive sector as well. So, you know, I think that's probably half the, you know, sort of 50% the wrong price in terms of your DAR multiple. Plus, we know that, you know, there's considerable amount of private equity activity in this sector.
Yeah. How much of the revenues do come from straight of it, you know, its own data centers? It's the sort of the hosting side. Do you know at all? Is it the majority? Because I know they say they've got sort of 90-odd% recurring revenue streams, which must give them great visibility.
Yeah, so the recurring revenue is really, I mean, these businesses, I'm not sure. I think it's still mostly private from their own data centers, but I'm not sure on the
precise. That's what I thought it was.
The contract model is really attractive because obviously you just, you know, people aren't looking for this type of service for a short term period. Sort of high at 90 recurring revenue, and then you should have strong sort of margins and operational leverage on that.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on to another one, another fallen angel, learning technologies, which is in all things sort of corporate training and sort of like also they do transformation for sort of like, you know, corporates and stuff. But they've got sort of 75% recurring revenue streams. And what's particularly caught my eye, most of the shares have come off, but they generated a lot of cash last year to bring the net debt down. They seem to have, they had a big acquisition, I think it was GP Strategies out last year, which seems to be sort of coming on stream. And there was a sort of a bit of a read across because Marlowe, which also had an M&A buy and build strategy, etc., came out, there's some hidden gems in that, and it's came out with a brilliant exit. And I'm just wondering what your latest is with learning technologies, because it seems to have been lumped into this thing of just discretionary spend, whereas in reality there's a lot of sort of like non-discretionary regulatory type of services and training that they deliver for their clients, I think.
Yeah, look, I think fallen angels is a good sort of appropriate term. There's quite a few businesses in this category where, you know, they used to trade on 20 times EBITDA.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're trading on sort of mid to high single digit EBITDA multiples, Team 17, Keywords, those are other examples. Yeah. But I think, you know, this business is, you know, it's a software and services business where I think for the first half last year, 72% of their revenues were from SaaS and long-term contracts. So, you know, this is helping, it's learning and development for corporates. It's underpinned by regulation, staff retention drivers. So you do have some quite sort of attractive fundamentals in terms of, you know, the value proposition and driving corporates to take this sort of software platform and additional services. So I think that, you know, when you just think about the kind of margin of safety, I think that's pretty attractive here. It's had some challenge from certain areas around, you know, a bit more bespoke content creation, which has been a bit more discretionary, but that, you know, that is a minority. And I think that has sort of played out already in the, you know, over the last couple of years. So, you know, where we are now, we're, as you say, we're at kind of 7-8 times EBITDA. The balance sheet is deleveraging quite significantly through the cash generation. They have some sort of self-help levers in terms of driving operational efficiencies and reducing costs, which we saw in the recent numbers as well. So, you know, it feels like it's a kind of quite an interesting inflection point. And, you know, for to see, I guess, quite material EBITDA growth plus probably a re-rating for what is, you know, as you say, a high quality business with, you know, mostly kind of SaaS and long term contract revenues underpinning it.
Mm. Do they own all that software? I mean, I know they've got the data, but the actual software as well, the delivery.
Yeah. Yeah. It's
okay. Well, it looks at another one which is mispriced on 10 times or 12, 11 times PE going forward. Okay, well, let's move to another one. Netcall, which again has been a darling, has actually done reasonably well. I think it does sort of software, SaaS software to contact centers. So effectively to help sort of people take, you know, consumer, whether it calls or emails or other communications, and to mix that with the human element and more increasingly so the AI sort of chatbot element, etc. What's your sort of your latest on this? It does seem to be a real class act, a bit of a sort of category killer. The only sort of long-term issue investors might have is whether they're going to be, you know, potentially disintermediated by sort of chatbots from the likes of Salesforce and from, you know, Microsoft or something.
Yeah, so Netcall is a really interesting sort of transition journey, I'd say, over the, you know, the last five to 10 years. So this, I mean, a long time ago, it sort of started out as a, you know, contact center software business. It was mostly on premise, and you know, the business has really, I mean, it's made some really key strategic sort of decisions around improving the quality of earnings and the growth profile. So, you know, firstly, the transition from on-premise to SaaS and to recurring is absolutely key, which they've really delivered on. So I think 72% of group revenues are now recurring. And the other sort of transition which has been happening in parallel has been, and it's sort of been enabled by the SaaS transition has been sort of broadening the proposition into areas such as intelligent automation and low code and robotic process automation. And, you know, that has been, so sort of not remaining as a siloed kind of call center software proposition, you know, to your point around chatbots, they, you know, they have, they've got their sort of omni-channel contact center solution, which has, you know, your conversational messaging, chatbots, virtual agents that, you know, sell that into public and private sector. But then they've also got the intelligent automation piece, which sort of augments that around, you know, allowing customers to sort of spin up their own bits of software and modules using a, you know, very easy sort of low code type development tool, drive operational efficiencies with further automation, RPA, that kind of thing. So, you know, the combination of those sort of two strategic initiatives has, you know, has meant that you've got a business that I think made about 36 million of revenue and 8 million EBITDA for last year.
Yeah.
Most of it's recurring. You know, the net retention rates are really attractive. So I think it's over 110% net retention rates.
That's not bad.
which is great. And if you think about, you know, what's great about when you get SaaS businesses like that, if you're, you know, retaining your customers plus upselling, you know, some seats, plus if you've got, you know, annual pricing increases on, you know, on that, you know, on such an operationally levered business, then, you know, the drop through is really significant. So, you know, I think it's trading on something like 3x
sales. Yeah, 3.2x sales. Yeah,
but I just think you've got some really, really attractive drivers for, you know, in terms of kind of people buying intelligent automation and some of those things to drive operational efficiencies. Plus, the drop through is really strong. So, you know, you could see that those multiples come down quite significantly.
Yeah, I think the margin
been really well executed.
Yeah, I think the margin will be increasing as well. It's about 16% EBIT margin for this type of business, which you've just described. It should be 20% plus that one, in my view. But yeah, okay, good. I like it. Tick in the box. Another one which has really sort of got attracted attention is Pinewood Technologies, which is formerly Pendragon, which now I think has sort of transformed itself through the transaction with a US sort of car dealer, Lithia, into sort of like a car dealer sort of, or vehicle dealer sort of management software platform. Can you take us through this one? Because it looks as though the shareholders, I mean, they know the shares are sort of like at about, I think they're about 36p, but you're going to get about a 24.5p dividend, aren't you, pretty soon?
So it's a sort of interesting special situation because it was Pendragon, which was a sort of vehicle, sort of retailer, so automotive retailer plus leasing business in the UK, and had this sort of SaaS business for dealer management software, and there was quite a lot of corporate activity with the everything apart from the SaaS business, and that has, as you said, it resulted in you know, essentially selling off the automotive side to Lithia. And you know, what you're essentially, what you're investing is just investing in a pure play SaaS business. So if you look at, I mean, it is really, really interesting, that business. So it's a, you know, firstly, the, I guess, kind of similar in a way to Netcall, the value proposition for dealer management software is, you know, it's like your ERP platform. If you're running an automotive dealership, you can't do it unless you have a dealer management software system installed. You know, it's like your core bit of technology. It allows you to do everything from, you know, managing the sort of accounting and the finance segment through to linking into CRM and after sales. And, you know, it's absolutely business critical. It's therefore incredibly sticky. You know, so again, the retention rates are very, very high. It's 90% recurring revenue. It's about 90% gross margin. It's 60% EBITDA margin, 45% EBIT margin. That is going to be slightly lower as they put in the PLC costs. So just caveat it with that. But, you know, essentially, it's a very, very sticky product. we also did a bit of kind of referencing on it, and the technology is market leading. So it's sort of cloud native. It's proper SaaS in terms of the architecture and the delivery model. And, you know, so I think there's so much resilience with that, you know, with Pinewood. What you would normally see in that situation where, you know, you'd be like, okay, that's great, but if it's so sticky, how are you going to win customers from anyone else? Because it's sticky everywhere. Which is a fair challenge, but I think that's why the deal is so interesting, because Lithia, so if you look at the path to effectively almost doubling EBITDA, so this business, I think it made something like 15 million of EBITDA for 22.
Yeah.
Company said they can make almost 30 million EBITDA by 2027. And I think you know, at about 33 or 34p, I appreciate the shares a bit higher now, but at about that level, you were essentially buying in at,
yeah, I mean the market cap. If you take off your dividend, you get a market cap of about 215, something like that, compared to 30 yeah. million market, you know, EBITDA, etc.
There is some cash in there as well.
Yeah, so that's less than 7x EBITDA in 2027 if that transformation happens.
Yeah, and so because of that operational leverage, the amount of users that you have to, so you only basically need to increase the user base by about 50% and you'll double the EBITDA.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing is that to get half of those users, so if Lithia, who are an automotive retailer themselves, if they added all of their dealerships to, out of that software into their dealerships, that would take you half of the way there.
Yeah. Okay.
So, you know, you've got a well identified path to, you know, perhaps not to doubling EBITDA, but to getting pretty close, say 22, 23 million EBITDA. Plus you have, you know, additional factors such as you don't have the vehicle, so automotive business, which is a bit of a, you know, a challenge when you're trying to sell to other retailers, because I think there might be, you know, from a competitive issue. You know, so that's going to be a positive. Plus, there's also a JV in North America, which is not included in that analysis at all. So that's completely separate. Massive market, Lithia. It's just a 50-50 JV between Lithia and Pinewood. You know, and so that's just all incremental. And that's could be quite significant, but that's all incremental upside. So I don't know how often you find a, you know, that kind of quality SaaS business trading at 7x EBITDA.
Yeah. And that's ignoring potential expansion opportunities in Europe and Australia and other places, isn't it? So
yeah, exactly.
I get it. Okay, well, let's move to a different sector. Still in technology, but in gaming. I know you touched on it. Team 17, another sort of fallen angel. Did obviously the gaming sector was absolutely sort of like, you know, boosted by everybody being in lockdown and playing on their mobiles, particularly, you know, sort of games, etc., during the pandemic. And as they've moved out, that's been less so, which has meant that there's been also sort of like more supply and less demand, etc. And the whole, how do you see this? It does seem to be pretty much cashed up, but very cheap. It trades at 11x PE about 7x EBITDA for a sort of an indie manufacturer or developer of games.
Yeah, so look, Team 17, another fallen angel, great business. You know, the market, video gaming market it's like $150 billion, probably more.
Yeah.
Within that, so Team 17, they're sort of an outsourced video game developer, and they're focused on the indie segment. So you've got a big market, you've got video gaming growing generally as a market, you've got the indie segment taking share also as a proportion, so that's quite an attractive part of the market. You know, they are one of the market leaders in terms of providing that end-to-end outsourcing proposition from development through to licensing through to new game launch and certification. And, you know, the other attractive thing about the indie space is not just that it's growing, but it is, you know, if you look at the ROI, so the typical spend per game is much lower than AA or AAA rated games. You're spending tens, if not $100 million. So the ROI is really, really attractive as well. So, you know, all of that combines into a business where you've got pretty attractive organic growth plus high margins, you've got net cash and strong cash generation. The reason why it's a bit of a fallen angels because it basically has had a profit warning, in part due to kind of strategy drift. So that, you know, what I was saying about not spending that much on developing a game, the strategy drifted slightly and they'd spent a bit more on some games, and that, you know, resulted in a profit warning.
Is that developing their own games or games for third parties under contracts?
So it's a mix of both, really.
Yeah. Okay.
So they have, yeah. So what we like about it is that we like the diversification of, you know, you don't take huge concentration risk into one or two games having to be, you know, big hits. So you sort of outsource providers to others, but you have your own IP that you're developing, and you get the higher, you know, the higher margin on that as well. But the diversification is key. But that strategy drift, in our view, is entirely sort of one-off in nature and has been addressed, been a management change that has been, you know, so that has sort of shifted firmly back to previous strategy. And, you know, we were buying this business on 5x EBITDA.
Yeah.
You know, it's completely the wrong price. It's been, you know, it's been owned by private equity before and floated. You know, so that I think is, yeah, 5x a bit of a no-brainer, really.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the UK is well known for its expertise in all things gaming. It has been for years. Okay. Another one in that sector, which has fallen a lot over the last few years, is Keywords Studios, which is a total, I think, outsourcer. Helps big games manufacturers do sort of like customization, dubbing, artwork, testing, and all this sort of stuff. And I did notice just recently Sony has decided to get rid of or make redundant about 8% of its PlayStation workforce. And likewise, after the Activision acquisition by Microsoft, they've also sort of like consolidated their workforce. So it's a bit of a, even for the big titles, it is a bit of a tougher space.
Yeah, I think, look, this again is playing into this theme around outsourcing. So I think it's something like 30%, low 30s% is outsourced. But that is increasing, you know, and this is the, you know, as you say, dubbing and content, you know, this isn't the kind of, you're developing a AAA rated game or AA rated game. This is not, you know, you don't want to, it's not that efficient to have hordes of people doing this kind of work. It's much more efficient to outsource and drive operational efficiency for your business. So, you know, we're seeing that this is a business that, you know, has traded on 20x EBITDA before, probably even higher. They do work on some, they've got some quite attractive kind of repeat work in terms of some evergreen titles that they continue to provide services for, and they do provide some support. You know, there has been, you know, this trades on something like 8x EBITDA. I think there's been, you know, again, another common theme across this stock and a number of others has been the whole, you know, AI threat, which is, you know, it is in certain areas, it is potentially a threat, but I think, you know,
GitHub.
In this, what's that? Sorry,
GitHub is one, isn't it? Where basically take, you know, IT software development, etc., and whether, you know, you've got these, as much as sort of like, you know, extrapolating what Netcall are doing with robotic process automation, you can simply do a lot of the customization using automation, which gives the client the power to do it in-house rather than actually outsource.
Yeah, and I think there's, you know, there's other bits like RWS is, a, you know, you see the shares fall by 20% when someone writes a note saying how the business is going to be destroyed by AI. But actually, you know, RWS and Keywords, they're using AI. And so ultimately, if you think that they're going to go out of business because it's all going to be replaced by AI, then that might be a potential threat. But I don't believe that's the case with either of those businesses. And, you know, if they are sort of thought leaders in terms of leveraging AI within their own business to drive those efficiencies, reduce the cost to serve, which they are absolutely doing, then, you know, you're able to buy the shares even cheaper on kind of sentiment or, you know, sentiment driven noise, really. So, you know, those two have been, you know, there has been quite a bit of noise around AI, but it's been quite a big opportunity to buy the shares cheaper.
Yeah, it's quite an interesting point you're raising, actually, because the market doesn't like uncertainty and tends to migrate to either black or white. It's zero or one. It's nothing in between. It's either terrible or it's terrific. And if you get if you're actually in the middle somewhere, or alternative, you may be a beneficiary, but you get labelled incorrectly as terrible, then your shares present a buying opportunity for people like you guys.
Yeah, and it can be way too crude and sort of one dimensional. I mean, a great example is Medica, which I remember even when it IPO'd and people were concerned around, you know, teleradiology being replaced by a robot. And, you know, that's just never going to be the case, is that, you know, that there are some elements where you can use AI to identify, you know, parts of an X-ray and to be checked by a professional. But, you know, and there possibly are some areas where, you know, that where they're not kind of as, you know, health critical, where you may just get a robot to do that with some tiny bit of checking. But, you know, that feature never really came to play out. And you actually saw companies were able to use AI to drive efficiencies in terms of their delivery model. But you had some market, which was public market, was, you know, having quite a one-dimensional view of it, quite negative. And then you had the private market, where private equity were buying all of the assets, you know, mm-hmm. either privately or in Medica's case, they took that company private. So you just can get these, particularly where they're quite big topics, there's a lot of media sensationalism, you can get quite a crude kind of view from the market on it.
Yeah, you're right. Anyway, that is good, because you end up getting price inefficiency and opportunities. Okay, let's move to another one in the software set. Special situation is Tribal, which is basically mainly a SaaS provider of higher education, sort of like, you know, services and software, etc., into universities and to that sort of around the world. And it was been doing brilliantly. It sort of come from the UK and then had a bit of a slip up with a large contract with Singapore University. In the interim, it just recently got a bid at 74p from Lucian, which I think the shareholders rejected. What's your sort of your latest on this? Because the shares trade roughly around about 43p, 44p. And as I say, they just got a recent all cash offer from a US trade buyer at 74. Seems a bit weird to me.
Yeah. So look, again, learning management software to the education market is, you know, business critical type proposition. We like that a lot. The shares are trading on, I don't know, maybe 2x ARR, 7 to 8x EBITDA. They're now trading over 40% below that offer, that cash offer. The major issue with that was that the largest shareholder, I think, publicly announced that they weren't going to support that offer.
Yes, that's right.
So that was sort of voted down. And, you know, the shares on the back of that, I guess the shares have sort of drifted, back down to 43p, potentially because, you know, the market's saying, well, that's, you know, there's a blocker to any future M&A activity, or, you know, which again is probably a, you know, not necessarily the way to look at it, but, you know, to that particular offer that, you know, that was blocked. So I think fundamentally you've got a really, you know, notwithstanding the sort of contract dispute, which is, you know, still in process, you've got a business which is high quality, proposition. It's very, very cheap. Good quality of earnings, profitable, generates cash. But it's just trading at the wrong price, and it's kind of, so it's sort of there to be unlocked, really. But yeah, so I expect it's probably a kind of watch this space type situation, as, you know, we see what happens with,
actually happened with that Singapore contract. I mean, I know it's sort of still in dispute and it's still sort of got to work it through. And I think Singapore have sort of like slapped a claim in for about 10 million quid. As a maximum sort of stuff, I guess. But what was the actual underlying issue? Is it just, I mean, it was obviously poorly implemented, whether it was the client side or the supplier side, or whether it was a bit of both, I don't know. It just seems totally out of order, totally out of sync with all the rest of the successful implementations at other universities. And I just can't believe Singapore's massively different to anywhere else.
Yeah, I know, it does look slightly anomalous. I have to say, I don't know the kind of ins and outs of the specific details, but around, you know, I suspect around kind of implementation, as you say. But yeah, it was quite a surprise because we, you know, hadn't seen any other sort of issues with any kind of contracts for that business. But hopefully that sort of, you know, that's getting closer to resolution. Again, we'll have to see what happens there.
And is the debt okay? Because I mean, if you did, let's just say, take a worst case. I mean, I've got a sort of like the net debt was just over 7 million at the last reported. If you put 10 million as a worst case on top, you get 17. But EBITDA is about 12. It looks pretty much, even at a very worst case, it looks as though it's not going to need any more money either.
Exactly. So I think the there's a there is a for the provision, sort of an order of magnitude kind of assumption in there for that provision around the level that you said. And yeah, the debt position is not too significant, so it's not, you know, it's not a kind of systemic sort of balance sheet issue for Tribal, I don't think.
No.
But I
Okay.
suppose as you see cash sort of reducing, that could be a catalyst for the shares.
Good. Okay, well, let's move on to Truth, and I know we've talked about it before, the unbundling opportunity, I guess, which is sort of like it does sort of software for sort of like the financial the financing area, early payment with Satargo, with Lloyds, but also has the gaming side, PlayStack, etc. What's your sort of your latest on this one? Because I mean, it's got a bit of positive net cash, but it's sort of realizing the underlying hidden value within that business.
So it's interesting you brought up Marlowe before. There's a few we've seen, I think Gamma Aviation as well. Essentials probably another. There's been quite a few examples of sort of companies which have had some, you know, some sort of latent value within them which hadn't really been recognized by the market. TP ICAP's another one, although nothing, you know, nothing's happened there, but you know, where something has, there's been a catalyst, you know, part of the business has been sold. And you know, if you look at something like Marlowe, it's been sold for, I think it was more than the market was close to, or more, maybe more than the market cap at the time. You know, it's just a quite an, it looks like it's quite a shocking transaction, but you know, it sort of demonstrates that, you know, sort of speak about some of the kind of fundamental value within these businesses. Nothing really happens with the share price until you sort of, you know, divest of an asset or crystallize it, and then suddenly the shares just completely re-rate.
Re-rate,
And I think Trufin's a great example of that. It's like 57.7 million market cap, 9 million of cash, although some of that's restricted in some of the entities. So it's about 50 million EV. And you know, we you mentioned Satargo. I actually think the most interesting business is the oxygen business, which is, you know, it does, it's maybe not as exciting as Satargo in terms of having that kind of convexity of returns, but it is just a, it's a very operationally geared business with very strong kind of 20% sort of organic revenue growth, does sort of early payment solutions, software into local authorities, quite a strong visibility on that kind of revenue growing. The, you know, the cost base are fixed, so the drop through is 60% upwards probably.
They got an offer for Oxygen, didn't they, about 2 years ago? What, 26.5 million, if I remember rightly?
Yeah, they got an offer
But it was
years
rejected.
ago at 29p. I think it was the equivalent of 29p a share,
Yeah, that's about right.
and that was before, I'm trying to remember how much. I think the business was maybe making 500,000 to 1 million of EBITDA. It's now making 6 and a bit million revenue. It's making over 1 million EBITDA, although they have they've sort of depressed that EBITDA to invest in the business. The visibility on that asset is just exceptionally strong. You can see a path from 6 million revenue to, you know, well in excess of double that with, you know, very high drop through. So there's a business which is sort of 5 to 8 million EBITDA probably. So we think that that is worth the whole of Truth in at the moment. You then got, yeah, you got Satargo, as you said, which is sort of lending as a service software, because some, you know, great customers, could be worth a lot of money, but you know, if we, it, there is a bit of execution risk there. You then got PlayStack, which is a, you know, small sort of independent publisher of video games. Again, in that sector, a lot happening in that sector, but you know, that's a business which is, it, I think, made about 8 million of revenue last year, but was profitable, and is going to make probably double that this year.
Yeah.
And is, you know, it's on a trajectory to being pretty significantly EBITDA positive over the next sort of 2 or 3 years. So that, you know, again, that's, you just got, with pretty prudent assumptions, you've got, you know, you could crystallize in excess of twice the current market cap, I believe, of this business.
Yeah, certainly with a bit of Goulston magic there. If we put a carve out PlayStack, give it, sell it at a good decent price to Team 17, move Stargo, sell that to Lloyds, and then rebrand Truefin to Oxygen, then yeah, you double your money within 12 months. So that's
easier said than done. There's a bit of a bit of execution to happen on that, but I like the plan.
Yeah, well, you're the Harry Potter of small cap, so I'm sure you'd be able to do that with that wand. You raised a really good point with Realizing, because another one last week was Animal Care as well, because they had a little small Identicare business for sort of like chips for not eating chips, but silicon chipping for pets and stuff like that. And they sold that for 25 million quid, which was only just PBT profit, just very small. In fact, it was really break even. So you're right, there's lots of hidden value. Let's just, you touched on it, TPI cap. What's your latest on this one? Because I just cannot get my head around the sort of the value. It's the biggest, world's biggest interdealer broker, etc. And it's got a data part of it, Parameta Solutions, that does all things OTC data, sells it into, but obviously does a lot of trading in energy and in interest rate derivatives and stuff. Trades on 6.5x PE, got a reasonable balance sheet, and 7% dividend yield. It just seems mispriced, which is surprising because it's quite a big company, about 1.4 billion market cap.
Yeah, so I think it trades on like 3 to 4 times, or 3.5 to 4 times EBITDA.
Yes, it's, you're right, yeah.
I think it does actually have net cash as well.
Yeah.
So they're doing a buyback. They've got, this is quite an interesting example of, I guess, where share buybacks can work quite well. And that's where you've got a business which is very cash generative, which is, you know, is by all intents and purposes very cheap. You know, it's not sort of in the view of the management team or someone else, they think it's cheap relative to history, but on a fundamentals basis, you know, it's really cheap, and where you have some sort of tangible demonstration of that value, and you've got that in Parameta, so that's, it makes 80 million, probably more, 80 million plus of EBIT, which is growing, I think, 10% plus.
Yeah, that's right.
5% margin on it, and yeah, the market cap of the business is about 1.4 billion. So that, I mean, that's almost worth, even on a pretty prudent assumption, that's worth most of the market cap of the whole entity.
Yeah.
The yield is over, the dividend yield's over 7%.
Yeah.
You know, so that the buyback is just reverse compounding that yield, and it's, you know, compounding the free cash flow per share. So even if you don't, you know, if you don't see a re-rating, the cash generation on this type of business is quite significant and could deliver pretty attractive returns, particularly if they're buying back shares. So I think, look, it just looks completely the wrong price. The you know, the challenge has been that Liquidnet has been, it's the conditions, market conditions have been tougher, but I think that's now even become, that's turned a corner and become break even. Plus, they are investing in developing other, I think they're developing a credit proposition within Liquidnet. So even with that investment headwind, they're still, you know, they're still actually, they have an asset which isn't burning cash. Plus the global broking business is, you know, that's on the right path to transitioning towards electronification. I think they've installed, you know, this electronic capability across over 40% of the in-scope desks. So, I'm just not sure what needs to happen. Maybe they sell Parameta. That might, you know, be a catalyst to get the shares up. But they look pretty good value at this point.
Yeah, I mean, it really sort of underlines, doesn't it, what you said right at the start in terms of small caps and UK undervaluation and price inefficiency. Because when you see something like this and you just say, well, you know, generates so much cash, it's got a decent balance sheet and it's a number one in its market, and there aren't that many people, you just can't get new entrants into this thing because you need scale and you need liquidity. And it's a bit of an oligopoly, I think, with, you know, BGC and with there's another one, isn't there? I can't remember what it is. So yeah, it just looks totally mispriced. Okay, now let's move just a bit slightly down the food chain in that same sector. We've got Forex service provider, or sort of payments provider, Argentex, which has had a bit of a sort of like a management reshuffle. Had a new chairman, I think, about 12, 18 months ago. Nigel Railton, and then they've put a new interim CEO in there, Jim Ormond, I think. And the previous founders have left. The shares have been really flattened, come down to about sort of 50p from well over £1. They've had a bit of a profit warning, obviously, but they're doing a strategic review. What's your sort of your latest on this company? And likewise, what do you expect or thinking of how the strategic review, because it's going to be unveiled, I think, next month at the prelims.
Yeah, so look, the market never likes management changes and profit warnings, clearly. So, you know, I think this business has been in quite a big kind of turn. There's been a lot of operational change here. And you know, it's unsurprising the shares are where they are at, given that, you know, as you say, the kind of new CEO in and change of chair. You know, I still think if you take a step back, it's the market opportunity for corporate FX services is significant. You know, it's multi-billion in the UK. It's mostly still addressed by the large brokers and the banks. You know, I think the independents such as Argentex and others have got a real opportunity here. And you know, I think that this, I mean, the shares on the face of it do look very, very cheap. This is a net cash, you know, net cash business, even when you exclude the client cash, albeit you do need to use some of that cash to grow. But you know, it's a decent balance sheet. You know, this business just hasn't delivered really the margins that it should have delivered. And you know, so I think that, you know, in terms of the strategic review, you know, there's quite a few different paths that these kind of businesses can go down. You know, you can go down the kind of, you know, the more kind of digital path, the sort of corporate, you know, currency card solution. You can go down the more sort of, you know, people-based type agency type model.
The white glove side.
Yeah, and you can, you know, you can go somewhere in between. You know, you can be kind of execution only versus trying to be more of a treasury management function with advisory around it. So it's just, you know, I think that the work that sort of needs to go in, and you know, hopefully is going at the moment, it's just really thinking about the fit with the market and the proposition that this business has got. And you know, I think that that is, you know, that's going to be critical in sort of determining the, you know, the path to value creation for shareholders going forward. But I don't, you know, I don't, this business doesn't need to be, you know, it doesn't need to be a kind of fintech type pure, you know, digital play at all. You know, it is ultimately, these businesses are, you know, they're effective, you know, they're sort of sales machines, but they, you know, they leverage sort of digital capability as well. But you know, the real driver is just that the market opportunity is so significant. The agility and flexibility that they can provide should lead to them sort of taking share. So yeah, so I think, you know, hopefully we're on the sort of path to kind of positive change. And you know, I think the shares are an opportunity, but in terms of being very cheap. But you know, it's just there is that uncertainty, I suppose, at the moment.
I mean, my take on it is that if as long as the guys and you know the Jim and Nigel have stabilized the business, then it'll re-rate just on the on its existing, on its historical numbers, which are obviously, as you say, they're a bit depressed, etc. But equally, somebody will put a number on these. They'll just get bought because there's so much consolidation in sort of fintech. But yeah, let's all we've got bated breath. Let's wait and see what happens in April, the guys unveil. Okay, another beaten down sector, less sort of tech orientated, is housing and property development. We've got probably the most one of the property developers, Watkin Jones, which makes student sort of like halls of residence and build to rent type properties, sort of like, you know, blocks of flats, etc., that they sell out. This has obviously been right in the sort of the wars of late, because as interest rates have gone up, then it's institutional money that's helped support these new developments, etc., have decided to sort of like, you know, take the foot off the pedal. What's your sort of your latest on this one? Because again, I mean, it used to be a darling about 5 or 6 years ago, but trades at less than 50p, and it looks very cheap.
Yeah. So I think, look, if you look at the asset classes that they operate in, purpose-built student accommodation and build-to-rent, you know, those have across the, I'm not a real estate expert, but from speaking to some operators in the, across the real estate market, that those two areas have been some of the most resilient in terms of the sort of the valuations have dropped, but they've dropped the least, and that's been because of the rental income growth has been, you know, has been, I think, double digit in those areas. So yeah, fundamentally, I think those are, you've still got the undersupply of housing for in terms of student accommodation. You know, the market imbalance is still there on a fundamentals basis. The challenge that you had is just that the forward funding market, so the participation by institutional investors to put capital into those developments has been effectively closed for, you know, 18 months since the shift in the interest rate environment. You have had some sort of private equity type investors who've participated, but it's just the activity has been much, much lower than it was historically. So, you know, we, as I said at the start, I'm not a macroeconomist, and you know, I don't know when rates are going to come down.
You're too modest there, Brendan. You're not bad, mate.
Well, I don't think we should be. We can't build an investment case on predicting macro events. But so I think, look, what gives me some comfort here is that the company has taken cost action. It's got a strong balance sheet with cash, and it's got, you know, tangible property on the balance sheet. But if the worst comes to the worst and they don't forward fund any more properties, I think they'll be just about break even and cash neutral for the year. You know, so we're not going to have a balance sheet issue here. Well, not in the near term anyway. Can't predict, you know, years and years out. And, you know, as I said at the start, we're seeing some positive signs of, you know, rates reducing.
Yeah.
Anecdotally, you know, we have seen a bit more activity in this market as well. So, you know, I'm sort of hopeful that these are turning. They're at a bit of an inflection point, and you know that the EBITDA could go up quite materially. That they don't need to do too much to be making sort of 15 to 20 million EBITDA.
Yeah, and I think also you do have two macro sort of points here. You've got if we do get, when the general election comes around, both political parties definitely want to boost housing and rental accommodation. You may have something in the spring budget on Wednesday, probably not, but you may do.
Yeah,
and then you've also
they need to boost the UK stock market first with a few initiatives.
Yeah, they need to do something, and even it's a strange one, student accommodation, because it's actually a bit countercyclical. Because if the economy goes a bit tougher, then more people end up going to university because they can't get jobs. So, I think they should be, you know, okay, you'd have thought. But, let's wait and see. Okay, another one, which is the Property Franchise Group, and they announced an all-share merger with another sort of like lettings stroke state agent business, Belvoir, almost a 50-50 sort of all-stock deal. Can you take, what's your sort of read across to this? Because it looks a bit, you know, it's not a synergistic growth, you know, sales synergies. It seems quite a defensive move to take cost out and to solidify their positioning in markets.
Yeah. So look, I think we're invested in both of these businesses. They're very similar in terms of what they do, and also in terms of the scale and the financials. And you know what we like about them is that firstly they're franchised businesses. And they're lettings focused, so their management, the management service revenue is, you know, that is quite significant, really. So, you're not significantly exposed to, you know, housing transactions, housing sales. It's also mostly out, or I think it's all outside of London across both of those businesses. So, you know, the London market is slightly unique. So, you know, that gives you pretty strong kind of visibility on the revenues. And then because of the franchise model, you know, but both of them are strong, you know, strong margin, EBITDA margin type businesses, great cash generation. And I think TPFG has been, you know, has been strong net cash position. But both of them through COVID, they were obviously they couldn't trade for a number of months. But when they reopened trading, they, you know, even when their business was closed, they still were generating cash and profitable. Mm-hmm. And just so the resilience of the operating models is really, really attractive. So look, I think that, you know, we do hold both businesses in isolation. It's just a bit of a fairly, I want to say, obvious kind of combination, really, because you know, they are both carbon copies of each other, but they're not, you know, they have different brands in terms of, you know, the kind of lettings and the sales, you know, the housing sales brands that they've got. And you know, so I think you're going to have a business with a much stronger market position, and, you know, you're going to be able to leverage some that, you know, they're likely to be some sort of integration benefits from putting those two together. Yeah. They're not expensive businesses. They yield really strongly, great cash generation. You know, maybe not the most exciting kind of, you know, it's not the Nvidia earnings, you know, sort of earnings upgrade type cycle excitement, but, you know, we like a bit of boring sometimes, and you know, they often there should be a very resilient set of businesses, really.
Yeah, oh, I mean, I would agree. Unexciting but profitable, and can exactly double your money over a long period. Then, makes sense. Another sector that's been absolutely battered is asset managers. Let's just touch on some of a couple. Got one of that, Schroders, big business.
Yeah.
Its market cap is roughly around about, I think it's a few billion, isn't it? What is it? Yeah, 6 billion, etc. Trades on. Well, it gives a dividend yield of about 5.5%, 11.5 times PE. Looks again mispriced, this one.
Yeah, look, it's a huge business. I think it's, you know, diversified. You know, it's diversified across asset classes and you know, across geographies. I think the interesting thing about it is that, you know, you've got the private assets and alternative segment, which is the small part, but is growing pretty materially.
Yeah.
Where, the, you know, they have taken quite a strong view in terms of exposure to that asset class. And, you know, so, you know, you see that as being a structural growth driver.
Yeah.
And then also the wealth management side, again, which is, you know, is a an area where they've got a really strong position. And, you know, because of some of the dynamics in the market in terms of, you know, the structural need for advice and, you know, a number of aging population and a number of other, you know, factors, you're seeing quite, you know, it's an attractive market to be in from a growth perspective. So, you know, I think you got almost a 6% yield, double digit earnings multiple. It's got great brand. And, you know, you do have, it's not, you know, you have some off, there'll be some elements which will be market challenged, but you have offsetting factors. And if you take a sort of long-term view on it, you know, I think it's got the ability to sort of compound that growth over time. And it's not expensive, as you say.
Yeah. No, you're right. Another one in that sector, Mattioli Woods, which is basically an integrated IFA stroke wealth manager, reasonably cheap, etc., but trades on a similar sort of thing, 11.5 times PE and 5% sort of dividend yield, etc. There just seems so huge value in this area.
Yeah, look, I think wealth managers generally have been, you know, Brooks Macdonald is another one, which is very cheap. You know, these businesses have been, as you've seen over the last couple of years, you know, the kind of cost of living crisis, and people have, you know, people have probably continued to, you know, make, you know, ISA and pension contributions, but, you know, some maybe not. But, you know, the priority is probably shifted to paying off mortgage, paying down a mortgage. Or, you know, they're just the flows from the average UK individual has probably been more challenged over the last couple of years. And you've seen that in terms of the flows into some of these businesses. But, something like Mattioli is still growing organically despite that backdrop. And I think that backdrop is changing a bit, as I said at the start. You know, so they've seen, you know, they're not seeing 20% type organic growth. It is sort of mid-single digit, but I think that's pretty good in a, you know, in a backdrop which is hopefully bottoming in terms of that, you know, that kind of challenge that it's seeing or that sort of direct headwind.
Yeah.
You know, they've got, they've also got the kind of wallet share of their clients is something like 20 to 30%. So, you know, they don't necessarily need to, you know, they don't need their clients to suddenly put more capital into their accounts. They can, you know, either drive that wallet share or they can cross sell across products as well. So that integration
Yeah.
piece is really important. And, you know, ultimately this is a business which can, you know, it's got a long-term strategic goal to double the amount of assets to 30 billion from about 15, and their EBITDA will almost triple to about 100 million EBITDA of that period. And, you know, you're buying them today 11 times, 10, 11 times PE, 5% yield. If you believe that growth story, then it's pretty attractive, really.
Yeah, and they might be a beneficiary of the car crash at St. James's Place because you know,
Yeah.
there's lots of clients who, now that they've the FCA have sort of banned exit fees, then there could be a lot of people popping out of that IFA into other areas, maybe into Mattioli Woods in particular. Okay, let's move to consumer, which has had the cost of living crisis, but let's go to a sort of gain a restructuring one, Angling Direct, which is basically, I think it's a is one of the big brands for fishing tackle in the UK. Had a really strong heartland, trying to expand abroad. And I guess the question for investors, there's two questions. One, margins look a bit thin at 1.5% for a sort of like a best-in-class retailer, particularly in the UK. And then two, are there is a danger they're going to get distracted as they try and launch into Europe rather than actually concentrating in the home shores?
Yeah, so I think yeah, it's a good point that you mentioned on, you know, on the sort of Europe versus UK. You know, I think that the, you know, the business is still meaningfully profitable and generating cash despite that. So it's not a, you know, it's not a kind of sudden change of direction, which is sort of systemic to the systemic risk to the business. You know, this business is like 32 million market cap, and it's got half of that in net cash, and the net cash is increasing. You know, so this, you know, it's not a business which is burning cash or has got, you know, a kind of a balance sheet issue at all. You know, it's trading on something like 4 to 5 times forecast EBITDA. And, you know, I take your point on the, you know, the sort of EBIT margin or EBITDA margin, but yeah, the gross margins are so. For, I mean, you've got it's an omni-channel proposition, so it's not it's online and in store. Plus, they do have own brand versus third party, so you know, both of those factors help to support, you know, gross margins, which are in the kind of mid-30s. But you know, there's possible scope to increase those. And you know, ultimately, I think you've got a, you know, it's not a recurring revenue business, but it's, you know, it's sort of hobbyist enthusiast type proposition, which, you know, it's not going to be the first thing that's going to get cut by consumers. It's pretty resilient. And, you know, as this, you don't really need to believe that much about this business to make an attractive return because of the free cash generation. And this is sort of a wider theme that we've seen across the market. And I didn't mention at the start, but, you know, you're seeing businesses which have used to trade at double the valuation, which, you know, trade at 4 or 5 times EBITDA with, you know, free cash flow yields of, you know, mid-teens, 15, 20% higher. You know, you can make your money back on the cash generation in less than 5 years or 5 years at 15% without anything else happening at all. And the earnings would be derated over that period. So, you know, I think, yeah, this is a, again, a kind of company that is, you know, just trading at the wrong price, and you know, could it be as potentially could it be a takeover target as well, possibly?
Yeah, no, I would agree. I mean, for a specialist sort of, you know, non-discretionary type purchases, you'd have
Yeah.
thought they should be able to get that gross margin up. When if they get the gross margin anywhere near where they should have it, which is, I think should be north of 40%, no problem. You know,
Yeah.
you should definitely. then yeah, they'll should re-rate. Okay, another one which has been through the wars is Halfords just recently. They've had a couple of profit warnings. I mean, it's sort of split in between, you know, traditional retailer of bikes and auto parts, but has got a really resilient auto centre, you know, vehicle repair centre type operation, etc. But shares have been sold off, has been sort of like intimated that it could be a takeover target by certain people. What is this? Is it, what's this one? Is sort of a stronghold? Is it a sort of like position?
Yeah, look, this is one that, you know, had a profit warning last week.
Yeah.
Look, the business is, it's doing all the right things in terms of, you know, they bought the National Auto Centres. You know, they are transitioning away from being a sort of product, discretionary product type business towards a more recurring services type business. And that transition is going, you know, that it's sort of in line with management expectations. So, you know, most of the business, so the reason for the profit warning is, you know, it's entirely driven by the areas that are a minority part of this business.
Yeah.
But which are seeing, you know, tougher end markets. So this is the, you know, cycling, retail motoring products and tires, and maybe leave tires for a second. But you know, the other two areas are, you know, cycling, for example, the market is down 30% versus pre-pandemic. People aren't buying as much new cycling.
Because they bought a bike 2 years, 3 years ago.
Yeah. And also probably because of the, you know, the kind of cost of living and, you know, priorities. There's a bit of consolidation in that sector as well with some of the online online providers, and so I think that, you know, and then the tire market's slightly different because, you know, this is where people are choosing not to replace tires when they need to replace tires, which is, you know, it shouldn't be discretionary. You know, if your tires are the tread is too low and it's illegal, then you can't, you know, you get, I think, 3 points on your license per tire. People are apparently not replacing tires when they need to. And so that, you know, that shouldn't be discretionary, but it's a slightly odd, irrational market that we're seeing there. But, you know, so those three areas, you know, again, those are difficult to predict. It's hard to sit here and say we're at the bottom. You know, but what I would say is that firstly, the balance sheet is okay.
Yeah.
So it's sort of, you know, it's a very modest net debt position. You know, the transition to, you know, outside of those areas, the company's taking market share in the services components. You know, they have a sort of fleet services business, B2B business, and they have the, you know, the kind of consumer services around MOTs and other servicing. Those are all growing and taking market share, which is great. Companies ahead of expectations, I think, in terms of the cost levers. So pulling out cost, rationalizing some of the things like procurement, and also, you know, they're shifting to a, with respect to tires, they're shifting to a sort of vendor inventory management system where they don't hold the tires on their balance sheet. And that's going to liberate some cash as well. So everything within the control is going well. They've been sort of blindsided with some further weakness in end markets. The balance sheet's strong, and they've got some cost levers within their control to try and do something about this. Plus, if you take a look at the, on a pre-IFRS 16 basis, if you look at the EV EBITDA for the downgraded earnings for this, for 2024, it was on Friday, it was about 3.5 times EBITDA. So, you know, and you could take that forward and say, okay, well, say it's not going to grow for next year, still 3.5 times. But the longer term investment case is still really attractive here. And again, that's completely the wrong price.
Yeah.
You know, there's a Beaterville leaked article the other day on some potential takeover interest. But, you know, there's a lot of speculation around about, you know, but it's unsurprising given where the shares are trading and the fundamentals of that business.
Yeah. No, I mean, if they get offers for things like Currys, who haven't got the recurring revenue streams, then yeah, I mean, it looks a perfect acquisition for somebody like AutoNation out in the States. I mean, you know, seamless, wouldn't it? Okay, let's move to Moonpig, which was a darling during the lockdowns. Does all things sort of like online cards and gifts and stuff like that. Expanded quite a lot. Seems to be doing pretty well, actually, in the UK. It's got about 4 million customers. say, giving the whole DI, giving the sort of the creativity tools into consumers to be able to do those. And I guess some of that's probably the demise of Clinton Cards, because I think Card Factory is also doing well. Take us through this one, because it makes very good margins. It's got a bit of debt, actually. It's sort of like it's a bit less than 2x EV EBITDA, I guess. What's sort of your latest on this? Because it has grown out into the Netherlands as well through Greets.
Yeah. So the debt's higher because they did a large acquisition, but it's coming down. It was a very cash generative business. And you're right, this again is falls within one of those fallen angels, one that we've not owned historically, but we bought it when it was sort of trading 8x EBITDA.
Yeah.
The investment case here is fairly straightforward. It's, if you look at the online versus offline channel for cards, the penetration of online is very low. I think it's mid-teens type penetration in the UK. So you've got a structural shift towards buying online. You then look at Moonpig, and you've got something like 85% plus of their revenues from current customers. So people who use, they're very, very effective at using that first party data to try and drive upsell as well. So you've got good coverage from their current customers. You then look at the for their customer base, I think the average person, I think, buys something like 23 cards a year. Seems like quite a lot. I definitely don't buy.
Just going to say I don't.
Yeah.
I guess it depends if you send Christmas cards nowadays.
That might be a reflection on you and me, Paul, probably need to remember.
We're stuck into the stock market too often.
Yeah, exactly. But that compares to, for Moonpig, their average for their customers, something like 3.3.
Yeah.
So there's then the opportunity for them to sort of take share within their customers in terms of number of cards. There's then the gift attachment rate for gifts. Yeah. So some people send, so I think
flowers, champagne and stuff.
Yeah. So 70% of gifts in the UK are sent with a card, but only 18% attachment rates is what Moonpig are seeing. So you can increase that. And that's, strong drop through as well in terms of margin. And as I said, so you've got, quite attractive sort of tailwinds there. Plus you've then got a business which has got really good marketing efficiency. So it's something like a 6x LTV versus acquisition cost for customers. Margins are, 60% gross, 27% EBITDA. Trading at 8x EBITDA. So it's quite compelling.
Yeah, I would agree. I think the whole sector of gifting and cards is sort of concentrating on the winners. It's that they've shaken it out. Clinton's gone bust. Card seemed to be doing the local physical stuff, and the online is just doesn't. It's people who, if you win, then you win big, but if you lose, you go south. Okay, let's just move to one of the price comparison websites, moneysupermarket.com. It does seem to have actually really turned a corner, and it's got boosted just recently by sort of higher insurance premiums, also sort of like, financial products, mortgages and this sort of stuff, I guess. But the energy still hasn't sort of come back. What's your latest on this one? Game pretty cheap, 5% dividend yield, 14x PE or 15x PE. But I guess the only sort of curveball could be potentially if generative AI does, sort of like disintermediate the proposition, and they do, sort of like web discovery rather than web search.
Yeah. I mean, I think there was Amazon that suggested.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, they've got, and they haven't turned up, have they?
No, I suspect there's much higher barriers to entry.
Yes.
Than expected. But look, I think that this is effectively an oligopoly, this market, and it's interesting. You look at Money Supermarket, and in any given period, you mentioned insurance being the driver of returns, and if you look back about a year ago or 6 months ago, it was probably savings and bank account savings rates, and historically it's been travel you know, post COVID when travel was,
yes, of course.
So it's the diversification is really attractive for us. Not everything fires on all cylinders all the time, but it doesn't need to. There's nothing in the forecast for energy, which is, you know, I'm sure that will come back at some point. But, you know, I just think fundamentally it's a very, you know, it's a very attractive business model in terms of profitability, cash generation. It's got a very strong market position. It's right in the front and center of helping customers, consumers, you know, drive sort of efficiencies in terms of cost savings. And I think the other thing that's really exciting about this business is that they have a sort of data transformation project that they're doing, where they're trying to connect and sort of unify the customer data that they've got across all the different channels that they and the sort of products that they offer, and that's got really significant benefits to lowering the acquisition cost of customers, improving the margins, and you know, so that's been quite an, it's been not a trivial exercise that they've been undertaking, but you know, I'm not sure we've necessarily seen the benefit of that. I think that's still to come. So so yeah, I think, you know, as you say, and 14 times PE and decent yield, you know, it's just it's a great sort of compounder for earnings and dividends over time. Plus it's got a bit of capital growth upside of those, you know, as those that data project starts to deliver.
Yeah, Future also said go compare. One of their rivals has done very well over the last years, and it generates a shed load of cash. This would be perfect target for private equity because they'd be able to fund it straight away, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
Balance sheet's pretty good. Okay, let's just move finally to the last sector, healthcare. There's a couple of ones. Cooth, do you want to say a few words on this one? Mental health, digital mental health provider, really dominant in the UK, supplying like the NHS and schools and stuff, but has now made some, has won some transformational contracts out in the States with California, and is hoping to renew its Pennsylvania contract as well. I mean, it looks, this looks like the direction of travel. It looks like a secular winner.
Yeah. The look, really attractive sort of structural growth area here, you know, sort of focusing on mental health, particularly within youth, which is massively underserved, a big priority for the NHS in the UK. The, you know, so I think before the contract win, you know, it's a, you know, software and services business that is, you can see being a sort of multi-year sort of earnings growth story. I mean, to be honest with you, the contract in America has kind of felt like it came out of nowhere. It was such a significant contract. And, you know, I was quite surprised that they, you know, the people that they would have, the organizations that they were competing with, you know, significant well-funded organizations. And the fact that they've, that they sort of won that has been, you know, a really strong, I mean, such a powerful endorsement of their capability and their expertise in that space. So, I think that's really set them up in terms of credentials. The challenge from here is just executing and delivering on
delivery.
That. Yeah, to having to deliver on that. And yeah, but I think, look, it's a long-term, really attractive space to be in. They've got a proper kind of position and you know, expertise there. So
yeah, I think that, I mean, it just says everything. What if California can give you such a massive contract against the world's leaders, particularly at the heart of Silicon Valley, and you win it as an, as a small, relatively small UK business, it just says everything that the thing works. So and works really, really well. It's best in class because they just wouldn't give it to a UK business to do that unless it was absolutely top notch. So I'm with you. Okay, final one then. Spire Healthcare, which is the you know, the private hospitals business in the UK, got three real sort of like drivers of the business, sort of like, you know, private insurance, growth of that as people can't get a, you know, an elective procedure for their hips and knees and stuff. That's about 50%. Then it's got NHS, which is outsourcing stuff to them because they hasn't got enough capacity. And then it's got self-pay guys who basically, you know, don't bother going for insurance and just rock up and pay for it on when they need it.
Look, this is a really, really interesting situation, I think, Spire. You know, the backdrop here is you've got NHS waiting lists, which are, everyone knows, are very, very long. You know, millions of people, almost 10 million people or something, I think, on the
in year, you can count it in years if you knew, if you go onto one of the, if you just start off, you just put it, it'll be years until you get
your waiting list for a hip operation.
Yeah.
Yeah, look, so you've got a huge sort of backlog of patients that need to be diagnosed and addressed. And you know, I think that this company is accessing that through not just through the NHS channel, but through the private sort of PMI channel, private medical insurer in the self-pay market. So, you know, that NHS waiting list doesn't just get addressed by the NHS, it gets filtered out through the other areas. So there's huge demand for their services. The business is so it's interesting. The you know the contracts that they've got in the insurance space are RPI linked contracts. And so there has been this sort of quite attractive convergence where those have that they lag because they're based on a look back period. So those are now going to be increasing based on prior inflation, but the company is sort of seeing low, kind of relatively lower cost increases on, so you've got those sort of crossing over. So you've got sort of double uptick in profits because of that. I'm not sure that's really being fully appreciated by the market.
No, I hadn't understood that. It's a really good sort of point you make there. Yeah, because you've got basically that leveling up process because it suffered artificially on lower margins because of that inflation, and now it should start leveling that back up.
Yeah, and those and the that, that's already that inflation's already happened, so that's coming. That's just it's formulaic. It's coming through in the contracts. You've then got cost out programs that they're implementing, across non-clinical areas. So, they are, driving automation and, pre-admissions and various areas to take out further costs that they can. But, the key metric when you look at this business is really around the profitability per theatre. So they're very selective in terms of what types of procedures they'll focus on. And they've come out of some sort of cosmetic areas to focus on the areas that are just, kind of more profitable. And so that's the kind of key metric that they look at is it's not necessarily the number of procedures. It's actually quite complicated to look, because certain theatres you can only have a certain number of procedures, depends on what they are. But the key metric is for them is increasing that profitability per theatre, and that is increasing quite materially. And so you've got a strong market backdrop. You just got positive tailwinds in terms of pricing, costs coming out. You then got a quite an interesting balance sheet situation where you got 315 million of net debt, I think, roughly. You've got a market cap of 940 million today.
Yeah.
So 1.25 million EV. And if you were to, I think the historic pre IFRS 16 EBITDA, something like 153 million.
Yeah.
So on that basis, it would trade at about 8x pre IFRS 16 EBITDA. But what that ignores is the fact that you've got 650 million of freehold property on the balance sheet. There is other value for other PPE that's not property, but if you just exclude that, the business is trading in basically half that, 4x. And that's pre IFRS 16 EBITDA, which I guess makes sense if you're not including the leases on the capital structure. So yeah, that again, it's quite a 4x given the characteristics, feels the wrong price there, really.
Well, that one definitely seems a combination of private debt and private equity coming in on board to take this one out, because it'd be perfect for an infrastructure fund.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, there has been interest, I think, in this asset historically. I'm not sure it's sort of gone anywhere, but yeah. So
yeah, I guess
there's something to be unlocked there.
Yeah, a couple of questions, I guess, is one: can they recruit enough people at the coalface to be able to deliver the industry demand? Because the NHS has been suffering to get nurses and doctors and consultants, left, right, and centre. And then the second part: is there any geopolitical risk associated with this if Labour comes on board?
Yeah, so I think most of their business is the NHS is the minority part of the business. You sort of have to do the NHS part. If you just refuse to do it, then makes life difficult for you. So I think they're actually benefiting from the fact that, you know, a lot of people, you know, NHS focused medical practitioners, you know, they like to work in the private pay market because it's more lucrative. And, you know, so, but you're still competing with, you know, the likes of HSVA and others.
Yeah.
But I suppose the point is really around, you know, you're going to have to pay increases are something that, you know, is obviously so topical. And, you know, they do, the company puts through pay increases, which are slightly ahead of, I think, what the NHS puts through. So they, you know, they do, they pay a little bit more. I think probably irrespective of whichever government comes in, that will continue to be a key feature. And look, it's a risk, definitely. You know, if I think the NHS put through was 4.5%, I think, pay increase last year. If that doubles, that's a massive headwind to them. You know, they have a lot of costs in you know, in that segment, in that part of their, in that part of their cost base. So I think, you know, it's that's kind of the key risk here is, you know, I think the business can afford to put through pay increases slightly ahead of where the NHS is doing it. But, you know, clearly if it's a step change, like a doubling or tripling, then, you know, but that's pretty unlikely, I think.
Brilliant. Okay, fantastic. Well, really, many, many, very grateful for all your comments and insights across all those companies. Some fantastic opportunities for people to sort of research in. If people want to sort of put some money into the Gresham House funds, and particularly your sort of stuff in the sort of smaller mid caps, how best to do that, Brendan?
Sort of veering into kind of dangerous compliance territory.
Just
here.
Broadly, presumably you've got a website.
I think, I mean, I think it's easily done on platforms, or just speak to one of our sales team.
Yeah, okay.
Go on the website and call one of them. They can help with that.
Fantastic. All right. Well, brilliant. Well, thanks again. And I think you're right. I mean, you know, I think small cap and mid cap shareholder investors in the UK should be relatively optimistic given the price disconnects between value and what the current market caps are.
Yeah. 2024 inflection point.
Brilliant. Okay. Well, I'll keep you to that. Cheers then, Brendan. Speak to you soon. Bye.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.